What goes on behind the scenes in Pacific politics and how does it affect us? Polytalk is back to unpack the big questions like, why is it hard to get medicine you need in the Pacific?
It came to a point where he was admitted where he got blood poisoning. He needed antibiotics for that, and that was not available.
Join me, Scott Whitehair, on Polytalk.
Search up Polytalk in your favorite podcast app to listen.
This is an ABC podcast.
This is a warning that today's episode contains descriptions of violence related to sorcery accusations that may be distressing.
This is Stories from the Pacific on ABC Radio Australia.
Hello and welcome to Stories from the Pacific on ABC Radio Australia. I'm Bobby McCumber. In Papua New Guinea, sorcery accusations have been a part of the culture for centuries. But too often, these claims end in violence, community rejection, and sometimes even death. In 2013, the PNG government repealed the Sorcery Act, which had once allowed sorcery accusations to be used as a defence in murder trials. Yet in many villages, the violence hasn't stopped. It has simply gone underground. Today, we'll hear from a woman who knows this reality all too well. Once accused of sorcery herself, she has now dedicated her life to rescuing others facing the same danger. Monica Paulos is from the Simbu province in Papua New Guinea and now resides in Toowoomba, Australia. Monica, welcome to Stories from the Pacific.
Hello. I'm happy to share my stories.
It's wonderful to have you here, Monica. Thank you so much. Now, you come from a small village called Aragol in the Simbu province of Papua New Guinea. What was it like growing up there?
Growing up in the village was, it was exciting because like you have the support from the community and you know you have family and like you're more secured in the village. So I grew up like in the village, but actually I didn't really grow up in a village a lot because my dad was working. So like we've been doing a lot of traveling from province to province. Yeah. It is really hard moving from village to village. Like you don't really know where you really come from because as a child, you go and you meet some new friends and new families and you think this is it. But then that you actually have a region that you belong to, a clan and a tribe. Mm.
So how did it feel to finally have a permanent home between different villages every few months?
It was really exciting. Like you start to learn that you have your aunties and you have your uncles and you have your extended cousins and, you know, you learn to serve food and how to do the gardening and there are taboos and there are things that you have to do and you don't have to do. And it was really exciting for girls to grow up and learn these things.
Mm. How old were you when you did finally have a permanent home in the village?
When I was around 13.
And do you think having a stable home made it easier for you to form friendships as a child?
As a child, yes, because like you learn that, you know, this are your, you have your brothers and then you have like extended clan members around and then you have places that you can do things and you feel more secured and more peaceful doing things.
Now, when you had been living in that village for a few years now, you said you're around 10 years old when you finally had that stable home. When you were around 15 years old, something happened with your cousin's sister. Are you able to share a bit of information on that?
Yes. When I was 15, we went home because there was a death in the family. And when we went home, like my cousin passed away. And when we went to the village for funeral, like it was dark and it was in the village. So once when it gets dark, like everyone stays in the village, in the hut. And they make fire and there is a hurricane lamp and this sort of thing. So you really don't see what's going on outside. And there was funeral, like people came from nearby villages and extended families and cousins came and went. But then all of a sudden in the night, like there was a sound, like a war cry among the boys, and then they started, and the women in the house said, put off the lights, put off the lamps, and the fire. So it was like, I didn't know what was really happening. And I just had screams from, I had screams and cry from women and from one house to another, but I really didn't know what was going on. And we were so, it was also scary, but we stayed in the house. And the next day in the morning, like, everyone acted like nothing happened at night. Nobody talked about it. But you could see people like whispering, women whispering and pinching each other. They were talking among themselves like, you know, like this person, like looking around, and they couldn't see one of the women in the village who's maybe disappeared or something. So they were whispering to themselves.
How did the community react the next day?
It was just normal. They did other things like the getting rid of the funeral thing, and like it's a cultural thing that they have to get the mumu going, and like cooking food and all this, and like getting rid of the sorrow and all this, and everyone has to go back to work and do all these things. So like nothing happened.
Right. How old were you, do you think, when you realized what actually happened?
When I myself was accused at the time, that was the time I realized the pain of being accused, and the trauma and the discrimination that goes with it, and the fear and all this. That was like when I was already in my 30s when I realized that. But before that, I really didn't understand what was going on, because everything was kept secret.
So you mentioned that you were in your 30s when you were accused. Can you tell me how you felt personally when you were accused of sorcery?
When I was first accused of sorcery, that's when my father passed away. So that's when I was being accused. And the sense of security, like I said, like your sense of belonging and all this is all gone. Like you feel you don't have a place in the community or in the family once you're being accused. Like everyone turned against you. And I felt like I really don't have a place, and I don't have that. I can't even say anything to defend myself. Anything that I say will be always used against me. So I was helpless.
Now, as an adult, you joined the Highlands Women's Human Rights Defenders Network. Tell me what this group do.
This group, they do mostly work around active citizenship and good governance, but they also do women's rights and children's rights. So I started joining them because I really wanted to know how to defend myself, and I also want to learn the rights, because at the time, like at 30 when I was accused, I really don't know what is women's rights, what are my rights, and where should I go for the referral network? All this, I really didn't know anything about it. So I felt joining a group would really help me to understand my rights and where I could go and what I should do. Personally, it empowered me. It built me up and exposed me to another level that, like, I also had the courage and I could really step my foot out and really start doing what I wanted to do. Because at first, like I felt when I was first accused, I knew like if there are other women like this, if they are being accused and if they cannot stand up for themselves, who else is going to do it? So I always have that in mind. So that was the drive that really made me get out and do what I to do.
Do you think your life would have taken a different path had you not experienced the sorcery accusations yourself?
It would take a different path if I didn't go through the accusation myself. And what I always said is to myself is like, in another way, like it was good that I went through, so I felt the need of coming out and, you know, exposing the feelings and the emotions and the hurt and the trauma that others are going through being accused.
Mm. After your own experience, what pushed you to go back and help others instead of staying silent or hidden?
I ran away from the place that my religion, from my the small town that I belong to. I moved away when I was firstly accused of. But then, like, when I went to that small town, to that place called Lae, in one of the provinces in Papua New Guinea, I moved and stayed with one of my friends in a settlement with her. And when I was there, there was a woman, she was being raped, but because he tried to defend herself and they used that as an excuse that she was a sorcerer and she was trying to kill that man, because when that man was trying to rape her, I think she bit off that man's tongue. So in that community, that was in close to a defense force and a university in Lae. And I was there and I saw people, like, they brought this woman, they stoned her in the broad daylight, and they were like, it was next to a police station, it was next to army barracks, and it was close to a university, and like, people did nothing. They were just standing there. And at the time, like, I felt like I just have to go back and start doing something. I cannot do it in another province, but I can go back to where I was being accused of, where people know my story, and I will come out and stand and start doing this work. So this is how I came back, and I started doing a lot of awareness, and I started helping other women, because I see that, like, the government and the people will not help once you have been accused. So that was the drive behind me that really pushed me to come out and start doing this work. It also gave me the inner strength to really stand up and started talking about it, because I cannot keep it silent, because no one is going to help. The people that were supposed to help are not helping, so there's no one who's going to help. So there has to be a voice that has to come out stronger on this issue.
Can you share a story of the first woman you helped escape from sorcery accusation, or even one that comes to mind?
Yes, I'll share about this, the young girl from a village. She was a small child at the time. I think she was in a 10 years old or 9 at the time, and she was supposed to look after a baby. And the village was near this river. And with other kids, like, they were looking after the baby while the mother went to the garden. And because she was a small girl, she also wants to play with other kids. So she went out playing and then came back, and then the baby got drowned because it was on the side, it was near the river. So they accused the small girl and they were trying to kill her. And I had to use the boys. When I heard about it, it was in my village, and they knew what I was doing, like, I do this work. So it was risky for me to even go close and talk to them or say anything. So all I did was I talked to the other boys. I said, like, I asked them. Quickly, I went on the internet and I started asking for help. And I think Amnesty International responded and said they was going to help. So I used the money to, like, give it to other boys, and I told them, can you people go and bring her out? And they were in the funeral area, so they quickly took that girl out. And I arranged the car and went and just picked her up and took her to another province in Goroka. From Chimbu, we went to Goroka on a bus. And then I went around and I talked to OZAID and I talked to the Catholic Church, and I said, we got to save this girl. I said, she is at risk, because anytime they're going to kill her. And I took her out. I brought her to my home. And I told my children, when they ask you people, you will tell them that this is your cousin from the village. And she's here to stay with us for a while. So my children knew about it. And they just went, when the neighbors asked, they said, no, this is our cousin from the village. She just came to stay. She's going. And while I was there, you know, I have to gather things, like, they told me to go and get the, I forgot this, like child protection access. I have to go and get the papers done, like go to the courthouse and get the father to sign and all this, the state decks and all this to release the daughter, because we just took her out for safety without any proper arrangements. So, yeah, when I was traveling back to collect all these papers, like the Catholic Church quickly arranged and they flew her to Vanimo in another province where the nuns took care of her and all this, and she was saved. But I took all the blame for that. And, you know, they said, oh, she's helping her kind. And, you know, even the father of the baby came and, you know, said I should bring her back because she was responsible for the death of that child. And like every time I have to avoid them because we just live in the same community, so I just have to move away most of the time. So it was really difficult, but at least the girl was saved and she lived in Vanimo with the nuns then. Yeah. That was one of the successful stories. But there is also struggles in there, you know, when it comes to the laws and all this, like you don't have to just bring a child out and you don't have to just bring someone without their consent and all this. We did went through a lot of struggles on this, but I said, like, if we wait for the papers to be done, do you think these people will respect that and keep it there? You know, so it was some sort of a struggles also involved in getting the child out. But the outcome of it was good. It was successful that she was safe. And she stayed with that community in Vanimo.
You're listening to Stories from the Pacific on ABC Radio Australia. I'm Bobby McCumber and I'm speaking with Monica Paulos. Monica, with many of the volunteers based in remote villages, what steps do they take when they see a woman in their community being accused of sorcery? And of course, we're talking about the Highlands Women's Human Rights Defenders Network here.
We have a network that goes right down to the village. So we call it a rapid response team. So we usually work around with phone. That the network in the village, like the human rights defenders in the village, could, if there's a woman or someone being accused, they couldn't call, but they could go into the toilets and use the phone to text us. Or if they don't have the phone top-ups, they quickly, like, they give us 3 missed calls, and it's like a signal that we know there is a danger. So we try to top up their phone, and they only try to text us. They cannot call us. And then give us the location. And then we work closely with the police and all this. So they quickly call, like we call the police, we draw a sketch map of it, and then we give it to the police, and they usually go into the village and rescue the people that, like in one time, like there were women and a man, they were about to be burnt. And the police went in because they just went and broke the door and to save these 3 women and the man. And people were like, they said, where did they get the information from? Like, they were surprised, like, the police could go and rescue them. So that was one of the best way that we used and to save a lot of people with that. But actually, the human rights defenders are the ones that are at risk when they are doing this work. Because when the police comes in and goes, they always try to find who was the one that leaks out the information and all this.
What are some of those risks if they do get caught or found out that they are the person that has reported the issue?
Automatically, they will say things like, oh, you're saving one of your kind. And, you know, they'll start building the stigma and, like, accusing them again. And they could even kill them if they think that it's necessary for them, or they wait for another death, or there is another misfortune in the village, and they'll be the next one that they will accuse, and they use it as an excuse to get rid of them too.
How does your organization support these volunteers?
Actually, a lot of the work that the Human Rights Defender did was, like, at the time was volunteer work, because actually there wasn't a lot of money at the time, but we did get some funding from Australia and OSAID. Oxfam Australia was at the back of us and funding that.
Was there a moment that you first realised how big of an impact your work was making? And if so, what was that like?
When we see that someone is safe and we find them a place to go and settle down and all this, these are the times that, like, we really see the impact of our work. And this is the times we really know what was good. Like, we tend to realize that what we did was good. And the other thing is, like, when we see a lot of exposure on these things on the media, that's one of the things that we always see, that there is an impact on our work. Because we try to, at the time also, we try to use a lot of media and talk a lot about these issues, because when we try to talk at the community, at the community level, at the provincial level, or even at the national level, it's not even getting far. So the Islands Human Rights Defenders, we try to work, build a close network with UN and Amnesty International and all the international communities that could help to really expose the issue out.
Monica, you've spent decades supporting victims of sorcery accusations and domestic violence. What helps you maintain your resilience in the face of such difficult and often heartbreaking work?
I think it's just that when you see that there's no one trying to do what you are doing, and you see a lot of people suffering or being put to death and in a cruel way, it's just like a drive that makes you want to do it, because it deals with human beings' life being lost.
Now, back in 2013, the PNG government repealed its Sorcery Act, which previously allowed sorcery accusations as a defence in murder cases. Did this stop sorcery accusations in the villages?
It did not. Like, you know, when you talk about the act and all this, you know, the actual thing is still happening, you know. People want justice, but it's the way that you got to implement it to make it people realize that the act is working. So we can say we have the law there, but actually it's not. People are still accusing others of that. So with the repeal of the Sorcery Act, the implementation part is the biggest problem. The act is good, but it's the implementation with the government to be involved in that.
Did it make a difference at all?
It did. Like, there was a lot of talk about it. People came out and talked about it. But the violence, the exposure came out very clearly, because a lot of people didn't talk about it. They kept it in a lot of provinces. They kept it so silent. And, like, it's like a secret in their own villages. They just kill women and children. They forget about it. Like, they just cover it up. So with the hack and allowance that came out, it started coming out there. A lot of people, survivors, start talking about it in this exposure. So it was also good.
What needs to happen to make things change on the ground level?
I think a lot of the human rights defenders, like the Highlands Human Rights Defenders, the organizations that are dealing with the social accusations and the survivors, they should be funded more and give them enough fundings to move around and do the work. And also fund the Department of Family Sexual Violence, who is also supporting them. So it's better to save life than to do the work, and we don't save lives. So a lot of funding that would help the local human rights defenders on the ground is one of the key things, you know. Mm. They're the people right in the community that really needed to be funded to, and also strengthen that network. The network that they have in place has to be strengthened. So in a way, they know exactly where to go and what to do.
It sounds like there's still work that needs to be done, but have you personally noticed the change over the years?
I think there is a lot of changes. Like, the changes that I could say is, like, the exposure of the network that is there and where to go to and, you know, to come out and talk about it. and the safe houses and all this. And the other human rights defenders, where to call and get help and all this. So this is some of the changes that we can see. And also, like, government is also trying their best to talk on these things and bring it out. So really, there's a lot, but there's more to be done, because a lot of these things happen in the rural areas and at the settlements. And then the other thing is, like, we have this family thing, so it's really, really hard. Like, the one took system, the clan, that tribe thing. So they tend to protect the perpetrators.
Is it possible for a woman who has been accused of sorcery to be able to move on and reconnect with her community and family?
It is possible, but then she will always live with fear. For example, in my case, like, I always move, like, I continuously moving, like, internally being displaced. So for anyone, any family or a woman that has been accused, is like, they're internally being displaced, so they continuously move. Internally displaced in our own country and in our own place. And the security that we usually get from the family and the clan and the tribe is no longer there. And the very people that you think will support you and, like, they do support you and they, like, you know, they're, like, there for you in your bad times. These are the very people who will be against you at the time of accusation. So it is really difficult. So that sense of being secured is not there now.
Finally, Monica, what message do you have for women being accused of sorcery? Can they move on?
I would say they can move on. They have to be strong. They got to learn to just take it as, take a day at a time and live positively. And any negative about being accused and all this that comes into their mind, they have to try their best to brush it off and live like others.
Monica, thank you so much for joining me from Toowoomba and not only sharing the incredible work that you do, but sharing your personal experience and uplifting those women that can't help themselves many times. So thank you, Monica.
You're welcome, Bobby.
That was Monica Poulos, human rights activist from Papua New Guinea. You've been listening to Stories from the Pacific. I'm Bobby McCumber. To hear more stories about unique and incredible people from the Pacific, just search for Stories from the Pacific on ABC Radio Australia. If you or someone you know has an interesting story to share, you can email us at storiesfromthepacific@abc.net.au. This story was produced on the lands of the Yuggera and Turrbal people. I'm hosting this story on the lands of the Kaurna people.